Stop right there. This is an illegal gathering. I'm giving you 3 minutes to disperse.
Go home.
I'm warning you.
What you have just heard was a reenactment of the Soweto student uprising of June 16th, 1976, 45 years ago. It's an amazing event, a turning point in South African and world history for that matter. Students as young as 8 years old and up from there to whatever high school years are, organized to resist the inferior education that had been imposed on them by apartheid in racist South Africa. Apartheid gave black education the lowest priority. They were only meant to learn to read and write so they could serve the economy of the white population. And in addition, the Boers, the Afrikaners, who were seen as the original oppressors, were trying to impose their language on those students, and they were just fed up. And they came out on a peaceful protest 45 years ago and were mowed down in their hundreds by a brutal and oppressive and racist regime. So we thought we would commemorate that, and we have tonight a panel that will introduce itself. So please stay tuned.
So on the occasion of the 45th anniversary of the Soweto uprising, hard to believe it's been 45 years, we're gathered around a virtual roundtable here. There is Doug and myself, of course, as well as Annette Lowe and Dan O'Meara. So Doug and I don't really need introduction, but perhaps Dan and Annette, you could introduce yourselves briefly. Dan?
Yeah, I'm a South African. I was in London in 1976 when Soweto happened, and then joined the ANC as a result. Spent 8 years in Tanzania and Mozambique, and then came to Canada, where I worked in the anti-apartheid movement until South Africa changed.
Thanks, Dan. Ahmed?
My name is Ahmed Lowe, and I am a member of GRILA, the Group for Research and Initiative for the Liberation of Africa here in Toronto. I've been involved with GRILA since 1994, and then came to be interested with the question of anti-apartheid when I was studying back then in Europe, in France.
Thank you very much. In fact, I think I personally met both of you through the anti-apartheid movement pretty much. So we have a history that goes through that. So what I thought to begin, I want to direct the first question to Doug and Dan, because you're a little bit older than me and Ahmed, and you were fully fledged involved people when the Soweto uprising occurred. So I'm just going to ask you both to think back to that, where you were. Dan, you alluded a little bit, but where you were and what its immediate impact was on you. What did you think about it? How did you experience it? We'll look at it historically afterwards, but let's try to get back to that moment.
Yeah, I was in London where I was studying, doing my PhD. The night of this June 16, curiously in my apartment in London, there were five comrades. We were all together, South Africans who were all doing PhDs, all on the left, all involved in anti-apartheid movement. And we were in what was then a trend of reading groups. We were reading Poulantzis's book on fascism, which four of my colleagues were convinced was the way of understanding South Africa, and I thought it was a load of cobblers. And we were arguing about the relevance of Poulantzis's idea of fascism, and my telephone rang, and it was then my then girlfriend who was in Johannesburg to tell me that it had happened. So that was the last time I ever read Poulantzis, and obviously we dropped it immediately and talked about this. I didn't have television in my apartment, so two of the colleagues, Rob Davies, who then became a minister in the South African government, ran off to down the street, knocking on doors, trying to find somebody with a television. And I turned on the BBC and we found that Soweto had happened. The news was very sketchy. We knew that people had been killed. We knew that the police had opened fire. And immediately two things sprang to mind. This was Sharpeville all over again. Sharpeville was the 1960 massacre in which, according to official figures, 69 black people were shot in the back by the police, killed, and hundreds injured. In Soweto, in fact, it was many, many more, and we never know the real numbers. And the second thing that occurred to us instantly, we all knew this was a turning point. I don't know why, but it was everybody's instinctive reaction that South Africa would never be the same again. And, you know, in retrospect, I've asked myself frequently why we all instantly came to that recognition. And I've written in a book somewhere else that it was the very word Soweto has acquired for South Africans the kind of sense that Suez or Munich acquires for historians. There are moments that the evocation of the word just signifies a whole change. History will never be the same again. And it was because it was the end of a period in which the extreme, the incredibly brutal repression of every form of resistance. This was the first breakthrough in that, that tens of thousands of young school children, or they not all, whether they were children, some were adolescents, had defied the regime, defied bullets, and white South Africa could not, once this had happened, apartheid could not hold. It was the culminating moment of the Black Consciousness Movement. It was the great triumph of the Black Consciousness Movement. It was the, what I mean triumph, I mean, it's a bit strange to describe a massacre as a triumph, but it was not seen in South Africa as a massacre. I mean, I think something like 800 people were shot dead in Soweto, but it became a symbol of a revolt, a symbol that things would never be the same again, that you can shoot us, you can imprison us, you can torture us, but we are not going to be cowed and destroyed like the last generation was, like Mandela's generation and the generation preceding mine was, that the old ANC, Communist Party, PAC, Unity Movement, all the old movements were effectively destroyed by repression. And what this one said was, no, it is not going to happen. And the Black Consciousness Movement had said that South Africa will begin to change when there's the moment of psychological liberation, when black people are no longer afraid. And that was what was immediately so startlingly obvious about the Soweto uprising, that's why we all came to this, and everybody knew it was a turning point. It would take time. Obviously, it wasn't going to be the end of apartheid overnight, but from now on, it was going to be a whole different ballgame. So that was my immediate reaction at the time.
Wow. Okay, so Doug, what about you? At this point, I think you're in Zambia, no?
That's right. My family and I had just, I say fled Malawi. We had had a traumatic year where I was trying to run a CUSO program there. CUSO, the Canadian University Service Overseas, had been working in countries of Southern, Eastern, Central Africa for some dozen years by then. And of all the CUSO programs, people in those countries were very sensitized to what was going on in the liberation struggles of Zimbabwe, Mozambique, Angola, Namibia, South Africa, of course. And in the frontline states like Zambia, you were meeting the folks from the struggle personally. And so our people came back to Canada after their stays in those countries of that part of the world, quite politicized and ready to do things and make things happen and to move CUSO and the other NGOs forward in terms of a far more progressive approach. So we had, as I said, fled Malawi. It wasn't a very good experience there. And they had found us a posting in Lusaka to replace the outgoing program director as project officers to work with the liberation movements themselves directly to help assist them in their education campaigns outside of Africa, and B, with finding and recruiting funds for the refugees in their support, in their care. And we had only got there June 1st of that year. And our, my predecessor had arranged a meeting with the NEC members, about the five or seven of them, I can't remember, Alfred and Zoe, Thomas and Colby, Francis and Posho, some of the older comrades. They're very, very wonderful people, lovely avuncular figures. At that point, they'd aged in the struggle, they'd aged in exile, and they were the ones that had led it in the 50s and 60s and had been brutally repressed. And from the 60s until the 76, it appeared that things were just too tight. The volcano was locked down. 76 did it. A week after we met the executive, their life changed totally. It was never the same again for the ANC in exile. If anybody wants to accuse them of having become complacent or whatever, that wasn't my experience with them. But at that point then on, they were a full-fledged, full-time operation making things happen for hundreds and thousands of young South Africans who came out via Botswana, via Lesotho, Swaziland, and Mozambique. Most of them obviously wanting to take up the struggle from where they had left it off in the townships. And it was clear, as Dan said, this was a turning point. It was big news, obviously, in Africa. We didn't have TVs there at all, but we were on the BBC, we were on to the South African news, we were on to, of course, the comrades that were there were getting news straight from home, from their friends in the country. And it was very clear that the project that we had in mind when we arrived in that country was going to be irrevocably changed because of what was happening in South Africa. And the fact that it coincided so close after the independence of Mozambique was a reflection of oh, things are really moving now. We have a chance. And while it did last another, I don't know, 20 years, apartheid, it was clear that it wasn't going to be able to lock down the people like that. And of course, the 80s, we saw almost a perennial or perpetual state of emergency. So yes, we too were totally excited and drawn into that. It was the three most dynamic years of my work life ever. Mm-hmm.
Okay, can I just add something else? Because Doug raises a very interesting and important point. In fact, that yes, it was in the context of changes, important, vitally important changes across the whole of Southern Africa, which Angola and Mozambique were the most important. They meant that the old cordon sanitaire, which was of white colonies that surrounded South Africa, you know, from Angola in the west to Mozambique in the east, that was beginning to collapse, and that the regime was no longer protected, and that had big implications for the ANC. But Angola in particular, which the year before, had there been a war in Angola, the South Africans had illegally for the first time invaded South Africa, Angola. South African army had at the end of 74, and had been defeated. You know, and very few people remember this, but the intervention of the Cubans in early 1975 meant that this so-called white supremacy, they had literally had their ass kicked by black soldiers. Most of the Cubans were black, Cuban soldiers were black, and combination of MPLR and the Angolan Liberation Movement and the Cuban army, this defeat was the first rollback for apartheid. And it was a very important psychological moment. And then Soweto added to that. And I mean, I should have stressed that Doug is quite right to say so. But the impact on the ANC, we can talk about in a moment.
Mm-hmm, yeah, so really huge changes going on within and without the borders of South Africa at this time. So Ahmet, before I move to you, just one last question to both of you. At the time, in that moment, do you remember seeing what became an iconic and very incendiary photograph of the death of Hector Peterson, this young 13-year-old boy, in another, a slightly older boy, an 18-year-old boy's arms, and he's been shot dead in the moment. And it, you know, speaks, you know, it was really a snapshot of the horror and the tragedy that happened during the uprising. Do you remember seeing it at the time? And did it have as much importance in the moment as it has gone on to have as, you know, the iconic image of the Soweto uprising?
Well, if I can just jump in, I remember seeing it. It was in the British newspapers the day after, and presumably it was in the South African newspapers. And, you know, one of the other significant facts about Soweto and the difference with Sharpeville 16 years earlier was this was televised. There had been, television had just been introduced into South Africa. So white South Africans, who were the only people who could then afford in South Africa to have televisions, were seeing the horror of apartheid for the first time. I mean, not for the first time, but they couldn't avoid it. You know, white South Africa could always turn its eyes and say, oh, we didn't know, the sort of German excuse. And now they could no longer claim not to have known. Sharpeville, all the images of those terrible photographs of dead bodies strewn over the ground and this dusty street in front of the police station, those photographs were never published in South Africa. Mm-hmm. And when I was a student in 1969, we put up those photographs on the campus, there was a riot. I mean, the conservative students tore them down and people were beaten up for showing these things. Now with Soweto, that photograph of Hector Peterson, but the images of the police, including black policemen, firing on this, you know, on this gathering kids. Of 20,000 students. Yeah, kids. And then reporters, South African reporters going into the morgues. The police said that, you know, something like 16 people, forget the actual figures that they said. They were saying, quote, only 16 people were killed, as if this was somehow excusable that you could shoot one school child dead for a peaceful protest. Well, reporters were going into the morgues and into Baragwanath Hospital in Soweto and reporting hundreds of bodies, and that the medical services, the very basic medical services that existed for black people in Soweto, were completely overwhelmed. So yes, that photograph had a huge impact, and it went around the world, as did the television pictures. And then every day, because it just didn't stop, you know, then the uprising spread to every black township virtually in the country. And for 3 or 4 months, the entire country was in an uproar. These school pupils were mobilized and they were protesting. And it was the end of the whole project also that was dear to the heart of the government, to Afrikanerize the population, because we forget that the spark that lit the rebellion was this policy of the government to force black children to learn in Afrikaans. There were no textbooks, and Afrikaans was the language of the oppressor. And that was the actual spark that let it go. So yeah, long answer to your quick question. The image was very, very important. And it was carried. There was a big demonstration in London that weekend, and I went on it. There were hundreds, oh, I don't know how many. The British press said something like 20,000 people in London. And we all carried posters of Hector Peterson.
That image. Well, it was actually published in The World in South Africa the next day. Initially, the editor wasn't going to, and then changed his mind, and they published mm-hmm. it. And then it was immediately banned. But by then, it was out. By then, it was
and the
out.
Editor, Percy Cabos, was banned as a result.
Yeah, and Sam Nzima, the photographer, never worked as a journalist again. Mm-hmm. He was terrorized by the police and went into hiding pretty much for the rest of his life. The beautiful little film about Nzima and Hector Peterson's sister, and they reconstruct the whole thing. It's fabulous. At the end of the show, I'll announce the link so that people can check it out. It's a beautiful 13-minute piece, but that does a really wonderful job of using that image to tell the story. Doug, did you want to add?
Well, I can't really add anything to the background that Dan has laid out, because it's absolutely true. The photos of Sharpeville had been iconic for us as anti-apartheid activists before Soweto, because they were just so absolutely brutally graphic, and there was just no question about the violence that underpinned apartheid as a result. But when it was now kids. Because remember, those were adults doing the passbooks back in 60. Now it's kids. And that was that Peterson photo was so graphic. But behind it, we have to now also go to the next step, because Dan had mentioned Black consciousness. These kids weren't just spontaneously going out on the streets and willy-nilly confronting authority. They had committees, they had organizational committees, they had planned this, and it was laid out. They knew exactly how they're going. And while we probably don't have all that much film footage of the front of it as we have had in Sarafina, for instance, in the film, or Cry the Beloved Country, where you see a lot of staged elements of it, they were nonetheless just as organized. They knew exactly where they were going. They had their songs down, they had their chants down, they had their posters ready, and they were dynamic. They were ready to fight. Mm-hmm. And so this was what that image, while it was the tragedy of the loss of that life, they weren't going to give up, because they were organized, and this was not going to be tolerated. They'd had enough shoved down their throats. They weren't going to have Afrikaans shoved down too.
Okay, I'd like to bring Annette in now. So Annette, I mean, you and I were kids when this happened, probably the age of a lot of the kids who were in the streets protesting in Soweto. So, you know, you're coming at it probably from a little bit of a different perspective. Well, first of all, I mean, do you remember it as, I don't know how old you were at the time, an 8-year-old, or do you remember the event contemporary to the time?
Not at all. Not at all. I had no idea, because growing up in Senegal in a semi-rural area, not a lot of political information were flowing through those areas at the time. Mm-hmm. And I was a little bit too young too. I was around 12 years old. So this is something that I have discovered later on when I went to university and high school. That's when I discovered this situation. Yeah.
Okay. And so what did that mean for you? Because I know that for us coming a little bit later, it became a big organizing principle for us, that event and that moment clearly galvanized people on the ground at the time, but then it went on to continue to galvanize new anti-apartheid activists 10, 15, 20 years later. I know that was my experience. What was your...
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating to hear about Dan and Dirk, who were around that period, active already in terms of politics, and then that's very interesting. For the generation of people like me who came after and then became very interested into question around national liberation movement, the issue of apartheid, the role apartheid system was playing in the Southern African region. For us, Soweto represented a step in our process of being conscious of the problems that we had to face in terms of changing things. And I came to know about the Black Consciousness Movement and everything that was happening in South Africa through my readings of Frantz Fanon and some writers who are articulating the idea of the necessity for a mental decolonizing of the African mind as a prerequisite to any type of change. And from that perspective, I think that BICO played a very, very, very important role in articulating the ideas behind it. And the Soweto, in my point of view, represented, as mentioned by Doug or Dan, a spark that would trigger a process much larger that will change the course of history in Southern Africa. And that is so because it had there was behind the revolt a whole process of organizing, of preparing, and knowing what they were trying to do. So the student revolt, in my sense, from my reading, was just a step that would trigger a process that whose aim or objective was to disrupt the apartheid system nationally, and also with all its impact in the region. So because of the preliminary work that was done in the mind, prepare the minds of the young people, of activists, to break away from the fear that has been neutralizing a lot of people, was a very fundamental element. And that is still valid today. I would say that that process is still undergoing, the process of mental decolonization to break our way of thinking, to be able to have of our autonomy of thinking in terms of what we need, how we would like to achieve it, what type of society we want to build after the end of apartheid, after the time, the end of colonialism. All those questions are still relevant. And the prerequisite, as it was diagnosed earlier by people like Frantz Fanon and Steve Biko, is still on the table, which is we have to go into a process of decolonizing our mind, having our own vision of the world, what we would like to see. And from that perspective, I think that it's influenced a whole generation of African activists, people like me, who were at the time studying in the late 80s in Europe. That was our foundation of our discussions, readings like Steve Biko and the Black Consciousness Movement, Frantz Fanon, and all those things were part of the material that have shaped our way of thinking, and that makes us involved later on in the anti-apartheid system struggle when he came here in Canada or when we were living in France. So that was the process for me.
So Gwen, let me turn it around to you then. Where were you? What was I know obviously you were young and probably.
Yeah, I was utterly unaware. I was 10. I was not aware at all. I really only got involved in the movement probably, became aware of South Africa maybe about 6 years later as a 16-year-old, but then really got deep into it more as a 19 and 20-year-old as a university student. But for sure, you know, Sharpeville and Soweto, it's what we hung our actions on. It's what educated us about, you know, so much of what Ahmet was talking about. It helped to teach us about what was going on in the country. And it was something that we could then turn around and educate Canadians about using these two events. So it was very much a powerful organizing, I don't want to say tool, but it just an opportunity to educate and mobilize and raise consciousness and awareness of what was going on in South Africa. And it was very powerful because when you stop a stranger in the street and you explain what happened in Soweto, even though it had been many years in the past, and you're talking about children being gunned down in the streets, people stop and listen. You know, they don't tend to wave you. You know, you'd have to be monstrous to wave away somebody who's trying to tell you this story. So that's really my memory of it, as an anti-apartheid activist in Montreal and returning back to it every single year. We did our commemoration, Soweto and Sharpeville. You know, these were the two things. And it was an opportunity to get out in the streets, to do film nights, to, you know, get discussion groups together, but every single year without fail. And Ahmet, I would have to say, Grila was huge in that. It was organizing these commemorative activities, and they were very powerful. So you're listening to Amanda here on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, CKUT.ca around the world. And just a little reminder of the people who are sitting with us virtually today to talk about the Soweto Uprising. Of course, there's Doug and myself, and we have Dan O'Mara and Ahmet Lowe. So please listen on. All of you in your own way have talked about how this was a game changer. This changed everything. And could we kind of flesh that out a little bit? Like, what does that actually mean? What, in greater detail, what changed? Maybe you can start.
Well, I just wanted to direct it to Dan because in particular the ANC had a leading role in the earlier protests and in, even in exile was still part of the struggle. There had been the 1968 incursions into Rhodesia, the Wanky incursions, joint expeditions with the ZAPU and ANC. And but then, nonetheless, from the inside of the ANC, how did you see things evolve thereafter?
It's complicated, Doug. I wasn't in the ANC when Soweto happened. It was Soweto that made me decide to go into the ANC. And it's important to say that when Soweto happened, I was very angry with the ANC because we had had 16 years so-called of armed struggle. And, you know, all of this propaganda coming in about the ANC is this great movement and this guerrilla army there to defend the people. And they were totally unable to defend these unarmed school kids. you know, and a lot of us inside the country were saying, well, what the hell is this all about? You know, if you had 16 years to build up the ability to defend the population and you can't, where the hell are you? And I mean, that was a very naive judgment. But it became clear that the ANC was going to have to, it needed, if I can put it crudely, to be kicked in the ass. And it was by Soweto. And what changed the ANC was this massive efflux of young black activists from Soweto, left the country. All of them wanted just to get a gun and go back and kill white people. I mean, it was they wanted to avenge themselves. And because of the way the whole refugee structure was set up in the continent and the southern part of the continent, they came either to the ANC or the PAC, and the ANC had greater resources than did the PAC. So almost by accident, most of these black consciousness schoolchildren, who ideologically at the time were closer to the PAC than the ANC, came nonetheless into the ANC. And the ANC leadership was faced with an immense challenge, because a lot of the old school ANC people were outraged by the ideology of these young kids. And some of them, like Slovo and Hani, were absolutely enthused. And the ANC was, first of all, had to find a way of providing education and training and housing and all of that for, you know, the estimates are tens of thousands.
I mean, Oh my gosh, yeah.
When I was in Tanzania, there was an estimate, there was something like 25,000. And I got there just a year after Soweto, there were already 25,000 young black South Africans. And you could see them all over the streets of Dar es Salaam. And the Tanzanian government wasn't happy about this because they were having, quote, a negative influence on the Tanzanian youth. I mean, these were highly urbanized black South African kids coming into what was still not a very urbanized city. And the Tanzanian government wanted to get them out as soon as possible. So opened up, gave the ANC the ground for the school, what became the Solomon Shlongo Freedom College. But the ANC then had to figure out, what was it going to do? Because suddenly they were no longer the vanguard. These kids were as angry as hell with the ANC. I mean, if I was angry, they were saying, you know, we were mowed down by the police. Where were you? You weren't able to defend us. And to its immense credit, the faction in the leadership that won out, I mean, there was a big struggle around it, but the faction in the leadership that won out managed to incorporate this critique and transform the external movement of the ANC and really integrate the vast majority of these young black immigrants, or immigrants, revolutionaries, into the ANC structure. And very interesting debates went on within the ANC. I mean, I was present. There were when kids were, I mean, excuse me for the term kids, but they were very young, most of them under the age of 20, certainly under the age of 25, were just saying, give us kids with guns, we'll go back and kill people. And the ANC would say, well, it doesn't work like that because we're fighting the system and we have to bring down the system, and it's the system that is racist, and we don't target individual white people. Yes, they're racist, but you can kill as many whites as you like, and if you don't bring down the system, you don't change anything. And I could see in the 4 years that I was in Tanzania, there was this huge shift in the mentality of the vast majority of these people, of these young revolutionaries who came into the ANC. They really got it. So the ANC was transformed as an organization. It wasn't a vibrant organization that I, and you know, it was a group of very brave people who'd suffered immensely, but could no longer control anything. And when I went to London, when I left South Africa in 72 and had a lot of contact with ANC people, I was struck by how out of date, how out of touch they were with political developments. I mean, most of them regarded black consciousness as a form of racism. And we had to say to them, you are dead wrong. Steve Biko is the most important leader in the country since Nelson Mandela. And there was vast resistance to this. So Soweto had to change the ANC. And it did. But it also changed, and this is part of the equation, and it's part of the answer to a broader question is, why is South Africa the mess it is today? It didn't change the ANC enough, but it changed the white population sufficiently enough that they figured out a strategy eventually to, you know, to tame the ANC, what in 1996 became the way that they de-radicalized the ANC to draw its teeth. So it faced crucial part of the white establishment with the idea of, well, we can no longer rely on the old repression of the apartheid government. These fascist tactics aren't going to work forever. And P.W. Botha, a decade later, was employing exactly the same tactics in 86. But now the white establishment had changed, and it was saying, we've got to inculcate, we've got to develop a black middle class, and we've got to get them on our side, and we've got to show them that they can enjoy all the benefits, so-called, of white civilization and Western consumer society, and they don't have to be radical, and we don't have to have socialism. So the Soweto, for me, the underlying question, I mean, apart from the questions you're asking, provoked exactly the issue that Ahmed asked about, how do you decolonize South Africa? And it hasn't happened. To a large extent, South Africa remains a society imprisoned in its colonial heritage. White South Africa, to a very large extent, is as colonial as it was before. Black South Africa has not decolonized itself mentally. I mean, I think were Biko alive today, he would be absolutely revolted by what is going on in South Africa. I am convinced that the Nelson Mandela of the 1960s would be revolted by what the ANC has become. And this thoroughly corrupt robber baron capitalism in South Africa that we have today was a result of the fact that, yes, the ANC was transformed, but it wasn't transformed enough. And we can ask why. I mean, it got to be very good at organizing people and sending them back for the armed struggle, but it never really posed the underlying question is, how do we change South Africa radically afterwards? It just said Freedom Charter, you know, because that was the basic program. The people shall share in the country's wealth. Well, that's a great slogan, but it hasn't happened. And the question was never asked, how do we go about doing that? Because it was just felt that, you know, we're not as bad as they were. And the point about, as in much of the rest of Africa, I mean, for me, the great tragic irony of South Africa is that the ANC had 20, 30 years to learn from the failure of independence and the rest of the African continent, from neocolonialism. I mean, Nkrumah nailed it right on in that book on neocolonialism. And Ahmed is right, completely right to talk about Fanon, and I would include Aimé Césaire in all of that. You know, that unless you say, you ask the question of what are we going to do with a new black elite? What are we going to do when capitalism, which is a great old fox and is not going to just collapse and die when Africa becomes independent, how are they going to co-opt our leaders? Unless you have an answer to that question, and they didn't in the rest of Africa, Nyerere and various other countries tried but didn't really work it. South Africans didn't either. And when the pressure came on, to Mandela and to Mbeki and all of the ANC leadership, basically they just folded. They said, give us access to political power and you can have the economy. And that's the fundamental problem today, that it's never really been addressed. I mean, there were people in the ANC who tried to address it. And I think, you know, had Hani and Slobo and a couple others not died when they died, Hani was assassinated, possibly things would have been developed. Biko's vision for South Africa was not what it is today. It was self-help. It was communities must rise up by themselves. It was do not depend on foreign aid. Do not depend on the IMF. Do not depend on white capital. take control of your own lives. And what we have now is this kind of succubus of a comprador bourgeoisie that is now unfortunately black, but lives on lines of credit that white banks are providing to them and have been corrupt as anything that we've seen in the rest of Africa. And this is the tragic irony of post-apartheid South Africa. We have, we must admit, the best government the country has ever had, but South Africa is going really in the wrong way. And that the, for me, the lesson of Soweto is that this immense sacrifice is something that we must constantly recognize, but that it didn't change the ANC far enough. I mean, I know that's not what you necessarily what you wanted to hear, but if we're going to draw the lesson of Soweto, and for me, venerate the people who need to be venerated, and Biko is very definitely amongst them, a return to Biko would be a very good thing, I think.
Okay. Ahmet, I'm seeing you nodding a lot, and so I want to ask you this on the basis of what Dan just said. You follow very closely a lot of the movements that have been sweeping across Africa over the last several years, Burkina Faso, Sudan, Tunisia, very youth-driven. Do you, is what Doug's saying resonating with you, or do you feel that this youth-driven push for change is informed by perhaps a mind that's more decolonized than we're alluding to right now?
Yeah, I think that that is right on when he's saying, in his assessment of where we are at today in terms of what we could have been expected in terms of transformation in the post-apartheid system. I think that one of the critique I have to the ANCs after they came to power is that they did not have the excuse because they have the opportunity to learn from the previous state that have been going through the process of national independence since the 60s. So there were lots of lessons to be learned from there, not to be falling into the trap of where they are. The fundamental question still today is one of the questions that were raised by the Black Conscious Movement, or the, as a slogan, like, the land is ours. Is the land still ours today in terms of the African population or the population in there? Was there any changes in the pattern of ownership of the resources that could be utilized to transform the country, to improve the quality of life of the majority of the population? No, I would think. When you look at the type of even the relationship, the coexistence between the South Africans and immigrants who've been coming from countries like Mozambique and Zimbabwe, the treatment they have to be facing sometimes also is a reflection that the type of mental transformation that was supposed to happen did not happen because the ANC, who was in power, did not trigger that process of modifying radically the education system and the mentality of the people. Because if you look at the sacrifices that were made by people who live in the region in terms of advancing the struggle against apartheid, it's an irony that some of the poor population who today find themselves in South Africa are being treated in certain way, and that's a direct failure of the regime in place in South Africa. And there's no excuse for that, because that at least they have some of the tools that could have allowed them to do those small steps in terms of impacting and helping people to understand what the enemies of the transformation process is. The question of access to the resources in the country, which is still monopolized by the same forces that were there even before apartheid, the rising of a new black elite will not be a solution in the long term in addressing these disparities between the population, because we know that you can promote some local political black bourgeoisie in the country. But what is the process of redistribution that is trickling down to the lowest level to have an impact on the population? A lot of people don't see that happening. And that what's the limit of that policy of promoting a radical bourgeoisie? Why delaying the question of the land transformation? Because knowing that the majority of the people would be in a position to feed themselves and then have at least the minimum resources to sustain a decent life, as would be advocated by people like Steve Biko in terms of self-help, self-reliance on community health. But if you don't address the fundamental question of land access, land redistribution, and then giving them the tools and then to be able to take over their own life in their hands, I think that's very, very problematic. And that situation is also happening in different countries. And that's why I will connect it to the rest of the attempts of revolt or that's happening in countries like Burkina Faso or Tunisia or Egypt. There's a frustration of the youth in Africa today and because of the unbearable condition under which these people have to live with no horizon in terms of even having a decent life to have a family or have a decent job to feed themselves, those kind of things. What is missing at this point in time is the alternative, the theoretical alternative that could work with these youth that are very frustrated and then provide them with a viable alternative in terms of change what's happening. And that is where we as a elites or something like that have failed dramatically because we have failed to engage in a process that will get those people politically trained enough to identify where the major issues are, how we're going to tackle those issues, with what type of social forces should be behind in terms of carrying those type of projects of social transformation. And that's also, and include myself in that, is this our failure as a new generation of political activists or African nationalists or who have failed to fulfill our role in terms of accompanying this movement and providing a direction for them to see the at least that there's something that can be achieved in terms of moving toward a different path.
Doug, do you want to jump in?
Well, just briefly, and it's something I mentioned earlier, and that is that the youth of Soweto were not an amorphous mass. They had structure. They had committees. They were organized. And over time, those committees spread throughout the country and throughout the townships of the country. And we had the civil organizations come up. We had to make the townships ungovernable campaigns. Refuse to pay your water tax. Refuse to pay your electricity. And of course, anti-relocation campaigns of all sorts. And so there was a spirit of grounding as well, I think, that came out of this uprising from the people who lived it on the ground. I know we were directing this at the ANC, and of course, I agree with everything. No greater person disappointed than me. No person more greatly disappointed than myself about the way things have evolved. But I do see even today on the ground in townships and in many areas, resistances. The student movement is still very vocal and ready to stand up and fight against any effort to limit access to education for them. The anti-fees campaign was very, very vigorous. And in the townships, there's still organizations fighting relocation, fighting injustices that go on daily. And of course, there's reclaims for the land. So I think there has been other elements that have come out that hopefully will be a resistance to the imposition from the top that the ANC has taken over by simply mimicking the bourgeois state that was there. So I see another side that I think has a hope for the future in South Africa that perhaps hasn't had such a chance in other parts of Africa.
Can I say something on that?
Sure.
Because I think Ahmet raised the key question about the theoretical understanding of all of this. And, you know, we can have a long discussion, and there have been huge discussions in South Africa about why it failed. And I mean, I remember in the 1970s and the 1980s exactly the point that was raised about, yes, we can learn from the failure of the rest of Africa. And there was this very smug attitude in the ANC, well, we're not going to make the mistakes that they made, you know, and we're not going to end up corrupt like they did. And what have we seen? So the question is, why did this happen? And I think we need to distinguish between two very fundamentally different things. The one is the actual process of revolutionary struggle, who who carries the load? Who is the cannon fodder? Who are the troops that actually engage and defeat the enemy, if you can put it like that? And then the other question, which is an entirely different question, is who benefits from all of this? And unless there is an understanding of the link between those two and the kinds of detailed policies, because it's not just about fighting fees or this or that, it's about having an overall strategy of how do you deal with this overwhelming global power of capital and of the United States and of the IMF and of the World Bank when they come to you and do all of the things they do. Unless you have figured out some kind of strategy about that, and that's what the ANC always refused to do. And, you know, I can testify to this personally because I remember very vividly in the early 1980s when I was in Maputo, working with Ruth First and Rob Davies and Sipho Tlamini, we put in a proposal that Ruth First transmitted to the ANC leadership in 1981, just before Ruth was killed, early 1982, saying we have to start planning now for what we're going to do, because there was all of this movement that you talk about, Doug, but also the trade union movement.
That trade
workers
union,
were organizing on the basis of socialism, you know. So we're saying to the ANC, we're going to end up, hopefully, in charge of the most important and richest economy in Africa. What are we going to do? We know that the West, capital, all of them are going to try and destroy this instantly. We have to have a strategy. And the orders came down from above, and I can tell you in the most brutally direct fashion, from a man who ended up running the ANC Plan Economic Planning Commission, was shut your bloody mouth. Do not make any more of this. We will literally purge you if you go on arguing for this. Why? Because the comrades in Moscow now know how to run a developed economy. And when we are liberated, they will tell us how to do so. Well, when we were liberated, the comrades in Moscow had already themselves lost the battle and were becoming oligarchs and amongst the corrupt. And this total intellectual dependence on the Soviet Union was, to my way of thinking, and you know, one doesn't have to be a rampant Trotskyist, and I certainly wasn't, this is the most destructive force within the ANC, that the Communist Party controlled the limits of what was allowed to be said and talked about. And if that you exceeded those limits, and if you said, well, you know, maybe not everything is perfect in the Soviet Union, you were frozen out, you were kicked out of the movement.
So
there is, and the South African Communist Party has never, ever begun to look at this. I mean, I have recently read the autobiography of Rob Davies, who did this proposal with me, who ended up as Minister of Trade and Industry and is just, you know, retired. And it's remarkable for its unself-consciousness about, well, we were partly to blame because we had no idea of what we were going to do. It's all about these horrible external forces that came and forced us to do this. But it's none about how did we do exactly what Biko was saying we have to do. How do we develop our own capacity to understand how are we going to take control of our own lives, knowing that there is this immense external power structure that is going to come down on us from a dizzy height. And that, for me, the ANC has still not done that. Mbeki consciously, by his gear, deliberately dismantled all of that. There were people in the ANC who were prepared to do that. They were all sidelined. I mean, Jay Naidu, who's still going on about this, was frozen out instantly. You know, we can go on and on and on. So there's a great deal of self-critique that needs to be done by my generation, by the people who made compromises. And, you know, I kept my mouth shut at times, because if you wanted to stay in the movement, there were certain things you couldn't say. You know, you couldn't say, well, what's being done in the Soviet Union isn't perfect, and we don't necessarily want a Soviet model in South Africa, because then you were charged with being anti-Soviet and you were purged. So there's a long, long history. And then I think that, you know, far be it for me to dictate what people should be doing, but if I were a young Black South African, I would be studying the intellectual history, not just of what happened in the ANC and the rest of Africa, but also what happened to how this great experiment to break with capitalism, that was called communism, why it failed. Because that's very important for the way forward. And unless we can do that, I don't see how we're going to get out of this trap of the immense power imbalance that there is at the moment.
Wow. I think that we have covered a lot of ground here today. And just to recall to our listeners that this is the 45th anniversary of the Soweto Uprising, when events moved so quickly to start changing the course of history in Southern Africa altogether, let alone South Africa itself. Any last words on that before we say goodbye?
Ahmed, did you have a final comment you'd like to make?
No, I don't want to spoil it because Dan have summarized it very on to the point, because that's the key point. What type of assessment do we do in terms of the experiment, and then try to uncover the limits that have prevented us from moving deeper into what we were aspiring, and that's very, very important. And that involved, of course, having a distance to be able to do some self-criticism of what have been gone wrong. And one example is the infighting that was happening between the different forces, whether they are from the socialist side or the Pan-Africanist forces, based on sometimes very minor contradiction, but we have to be able to critique that, because in one of my recent papers, I mentioned that if there is a way to reconstruct a process of radical change in Africa, it will have to come with a reconciliation of those two tendencies, those from the left, radical left, the socialist movement, and those from the Pan-Africanist movement. And this can be done easily because some people are in both sides. They are Pan-Africanists, they are socialists, some of them. So we have to learn from the experience from the past in order to build something new. But the good part is that Africa is on a move. The youth is on a move. The youth is trying to find a solution. It is up to the recent generation of political activists to be ingrained into those processes and then accompany this movement to provide them the direction and infuse them in their daily struggle to find a solution to the current problems.
Well, I think that's the perfect spot to end it at. So Ahmed Lo, Dan O'Meara, thank you so much for joining us. It's always great to talk to both of you, and it's been great. Thanks so much.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's our tribute and commemoration of the historic uprising of the Soweto students in 1976. It was an important event, and we have to remember it because it does have a special place in history. Gwen, what else?
Well, listen, I want to wrap up by saying that I did briefly mention during the roundtable discussion a sweet little 13-minute film. It's called Sam Nzima, the man behind the iconic photo of the fight against apartheid. Don't need to get into the photo. It was discussed in depth at the table, really a very beautiful, meaningful discussion of it. But I urge you to go and check it out. If you just Google Sam Nzima, the man behind the iconic photo of the fight against apartheid, it will come up. It was originally, I think, produced by Time. It's on the BBC News site. It's the photographer Sam Nzima himself, and it also features Hector Peterson's sister. Very eloquent. The two of them tell the story from their own perspectives, and it really rounds out our discussion, I think, quite well. So again, I want to thank Dan and Ahmed for a very eloquent and deeply insightful exploration of the importance of this day, not only in the past, but I think as we move into the future. So thanks so much for joining us here on Amandla. We will be back next week. Stay tuned now for Jazz Euphoria.
And Gwen, Amandla!
Amandla! Amandla! Oliver Tambo!
Oliver Tambo!
Teta Lobota!
Oliver Tambo,
Teta Lobota,
Oliver Tambo, Teta Lobota,
Oliver Tambo,
Oliver Tambo, Teta Lobota,
Oliver Tambo,
Oliver Tambo,
we've all learned from COVID-19 is that something small can spread quickly, like a ripple. If enough of us do our part by getting vaccinated, we can start a wave. A wave of Canadians helping each other return to the people and places we love. We can all help by getting vaccinated. Learn more at canada.ca/COVID vaccine. A message from the Government of Canada.
Hello, listeners. This is Gambletron and Johnny Forever. Join us here on CKUT Friday, June 18th from 3 to 5 p.m. for a live broadcast of our performance Thin Walls Bad Internet Co. presented by Underfine Radio in Suoni Gurilpo Villa. And utilize your flesh body to come watch us on June 18th to the 21st live at 6835 Plaza St. Hubert as we build a pirate radio station and resonant sound sculpture from construction site detritus. Over Zoom. To find out more, visit undefinedradio.fm.
CKUT, Henry Grimes. And stay tuned for more of the most aesthetic things, feelings in the world.